We're going to be spending this week and next week doing Sefer Shoftim. And then before we get into Shmuel, just to go backwards a little bit, we were discussing the very first Shofets that after Yehoshua died, and there were a number of years where the land of Israel and the people of Israel were under foreign occupation. So the Shofet that redeemed the people from that first foreign occupation was the first Shofet, who is Othniel ben Kenaz. And Othniel ben Kenaz, you'll recall, is also Othniel. Ayin, Tuf, Nun, Yud, Aleph, Lamed. He is also mentioned in the book of Yehoshua. He is both a stepbrother, or perhaps a half-brother, of Kalev ben Yefuneh. And he also married Kalev's daughter. And he is known in rabbinic tradition as the person who restored 3,000 halachot that were forgotten in the aftermath of Moshe's death. Remember, Yehoshua kind of boasted and said, Moshe asked him, can I tell you anything before I go? And Yehoshua says, I know everything. And of course, as often happens, he forgot a lot of stuff. The people wanted to stone him, and Othniel ben Kenaz was able to restore those halachot through his pilpul. Pilpul is the in-depth understanding and analysis of halacha. Now, here's one thing. Before we leave Othniel, it's very, very important to recognize that there's a whole major section of the Book of Judges that refers to events that occurred in Othniel ben Kenaz's reign, which does not appear until the very end of the book. And that is, starting from Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, until the end of chapter 21, which is the end of the book, there are two major stories. One involves what is called Pesel Micha, the idol of Micha, which we'll discuss. And the other, which is even more infamous, is Pilegesh B'Givah, the concubine in Givah. Givah is the name of the town in Binyaminite territory. Now, these stories appear at the end of the book of Judges. But in point of fact, there is internal evidence, as well as Midrashim, that say that these two stories actually happened at the very beginning of the Tekufa of the Shoftim. And these are examples of Ein Muktam Umuchar Batorah. Of course, Torah is not only Torah, but in Tanakh generally, we don't always follow chronological order. And what I want is, I want to go over those stories, because those stories, in other words, why are they put at the end? Because they are really a segue to the book of Shmuel, which is the establishment of the monarchy. Because they show, in a graphing, disturbing, and tragic way, the need for there to be a monarchy. So it's actually moved at the end to kind of indicate how bad things were morally and spiritually during the period of the judges. Okay, so remember that starting from Perek Yud Zayin to the end of Chaf Aleph, from 17 to 21, is Ein Muktam Umuchar Batorah, and you should actually read it as if it appeared in the reign of Othniel ben Kenaz, which is interesting, because number one, his name is not mentioned at all here, and he's normally identified as a righteous, good judge, and apparently there's a suggestion here of helplessness in the face of a moral degradation that was so pervasive that even the righteous Shofets could not restrain what was going on. I mean, if you were to make a list of the immoral behaviors, you could come up with 20 or 30 of them. It might be a student project. Mm-hmm. List everything that was done wrong in these two stories. You can come up with quite a large list. And of course, the refrain that is mentioned several times, Ish kol hayasher b'einav, everyone did what they wanted. Now, the first story seems a little less innocuous, simply because it does not involve so much Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, interpersonal, but it does involve Bein Adam L'Makom. And if you turn to chapter 17, Perek Yud Zayin, and some of this is very contemporary. In fact, some of the book of Shoftim reminds us of juvenile delinquencies that we see even today. It says, Vahi Ish Mehar Ephraim, there was a man who lived in the hill country of the tribe of Ephraim. This is the center of Israel. His name was Michayahu, And generally he's referred to as Micha. Now, keep in mind, don't be confused. There is, of course, a biblical prophet, the name Micha, who is a very righteous prophet who was much later. This is the bad Micha. Or actually, well, we'll see. Is he bad or naive or maybe even a little, you know, a little mentally slow in various ways? I think, you know, it's not really clear. But he's not the prophet Micha. Vayomer le'imo. He goes over to his mother and says, you know, Elef umeya hakezev asher lukach lach. There was 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen from you. Remember that silver that was stolen from you? Fiat alis, and you were cursing the person who took it. I hear it as whether swearing. He says, "Vagam amart biaznai," and you even told me, "Hinei akesev iti," the money that was with me was taken. So the son says, "Well, you know, mom, ani lekachtiv. I'm the one that stole it." So he comes clean and tells mom, "I'm the one that stole it." So she had been cursing a few moments ago. But Tomer Imo, so the mother says, Baruch B'ni Lashem, may God bless you, my son, for admitting your crime. So, already you see a certain hint that the relationship was such that he could simply steal a very large amount of money from his mother. And by admitting it and returning it, she now blesses him. No discipline, no consequences. So the idea of Ish, Kol HaYashar B'Einav, is not only on the macro level of how the nation was run, but apparently it's also on the individual relationship of parent and child. Okay, that's step one. So, then it goes on and says, he returns. Of course, it's interesting, we're not given any motive of why he decided to repent. I mean, that's interesting too. But he returns the money to his mother, and his mother says, "Behold, I am so grateful that you've given me back the money. I am consecrating it for God," which in itself could be a good thing. I'm giving it to God. But what she does is she gives it to her son and says, "Here, take this money that I dedicated to God and go make an idol so we can worship God." So in effect, she instructs him to take some of this money that he had stolen. He gives it back to her and he tells her son, her lovely son, "Go make pesel umasecha. Go make an idol and a graven image." Now, Rashi makes a very interesting observation, which he rejects. We haven't looked at it yet, but right before, in the narrative of the book of Shoftim, right before this story is the story of Shimshon and Delilah. Now, of course, this is much earlier, but if you follow it sequentially. Now, Rashi quotes some Midrashim, which actually make a lot of sense structurally, that this woman was none other than Delilah. And the reason she had the 1,100 pieces of silver is, if you read the actual narrative beforehand, when she was paid off to expose the source of Shimshon's strength, she was given 1,100 pieces of silver. So it's very tempting to say, oh, this is Delilah, and this is her son from some marriage. We don't know what marriage it is. Of course, there's a lot of problems with that, because Delilah is described as a Philistine woman, and this guy, Michayo, is described as a Jew who lives in Mount Ephraim. So unless Delilah's husband, other than Shimshon, was Jewish, and of course the child would still be not Jewish under matrilineal descent, so it's very problematical. But the Medrash does say it's tantalizing that this figure of 1,100 pieces of silver is the exact figure that was mentioned in Delilah's payoff to expose Shimshon. But Rashi ultimately rejects that pshat simply because, given the fact that our understanding is Ein Mukdam U'Muchar B'Torah, the whole story of Micha is much earlier than the story of Shimshon. So because of that alone, it could not be. Rashi does say, however, that the reason they're connected in the composition of the book is both involved money that was utilized towards an evil end. Delilah's money, the money she received, resulted in Shimshon being exposed, and this money was used to build an idol, the Pesel U'Masecha.
The mother is saying to her son, Baruch B'ni L'Adonai.
Mm-hmm.
So she is referring to the eternal God.
That's correct.
And from the other side, she is telling him, go make a pesel and masecha.
Right, right.
So this is a contradiction.
There seems to be a contradiction.
That.
Yeah, it's a good question. So that's a very good question. The answer seems to be that according to the Rambam, Maimonides, for example, explains that the origin of idolatry was not a disbelief in a supreme God. even an idol worship believes in the supreme God, but believes that you also can worship the subordinates, the officials, the secretaries, the undersecretaries. So the Pesel u'Masecha was not a denial of the supreme God, but they thought it was a way of giving homage to God by worshiping his servants. And therefore, in fact, the Ramban says that's the story of the golden calf. The golden calf was also not a denial of God, but it was the belief in worshiping intermediaries as a way of getting to God. But you can see already that it is indeed true. She uses the name of God, which is only used for the divinity, and yet she tells her son to make a pesel u'masecha. Okay, now here, this Micha was very enthusiastic about this project. Not only did he hire a silversmith, a tzoref, to make the pesel, but he also made what is called a Beit Elohim, which means a temple. He erected a house of God. Here it means idolatry. He erected a temple. He made for himself a fod utrafim. Now this is an interesting phrase. A fod, which is translated as some type of apron, this was actually one of the garments that the Kohen Gadol wore. So he's not even a Kohen. He makes himself the garments of the Kohen Gadol. In other words, he now fancies himself a new Kohen for this Pesel u'Masecha. And, now Trafim is a little different. Trafim is mentioned in the Chumash.
Rachel.
That's correct, that's correct. When Rachel escaped from her father Lavan with Yaakov, she took the Trafim. The Trafim. And the Trafim, again, there are many, many different interpretations. They seem to be small households, idols or fetishes, which were said to bring good luck to the home. Some say there were shrunken skulls. That's how some interpret the trefillin. But again, the point was they were a paganistic symbol, which was designed to bring good luck in the family. So he was kind of hedging his bets. He makes a pesel u'masecha, a big idol, and then he has an ephod, which is the garments of the Kohen Gadol, and he has the little trefillin. And he becomes a Kohen, it says. You get a sense, by the way, that the narrator is employing some of these terms in a mocking, perhaps satirical sense. That here is a person who fancies himself as a Kohen, and now he's doing all of the services that would be done in the temple. Now, just to remind people, at this time there is no temple yet. There is no Beit HaMikdash. That's King Solomon. That's much, much later. But the Mishkan of the desert is presently located in Shiloh, around the West Bank, Shiloh. So there is a Mishkan, there is a centralized sanctuary of worship, but he's now setting up this little place for Avodah Zarah, and this is commonly called in rabbinic literature Pesel Micha, the idol of Micha.
What was the relationship between Samson and Delilah? Were they man and wife?
Well, halachically they could not be man and wife because she was not Jewish. It seems that he regarded her as his wife. She did not regard him as her husband. Apparently, she was not very, very loyal to him.
She was not faithful about it.
Yeah, but he regarded her as his wife.
I never understood.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Okay, now, then it goes on and gives you a further story. Look at verse 6. Verse 6, of course, kind of sets the tone. The Yamim Ahim, in those days. By the way, according to the Gemara, the author of the book of Judges was actually the prophet Shmuel. So it's interesting that Shmuel is the author of this narrative. In retrospect, he is recording these events. So it says, "Bayamim ahem, in those days, ain melech b'Yisrael, there was no king, there was no central authority. Ish hayashar b'einav yaseh, everybody did whatever was right in their eyes." And again, it's very, very clear. This pasuk is almost never stated in a positive sense. This pasuk is there to set the tone of lawlessness, of violence, of what we call hefkehut, where people just do whatever they want to say.
Well, I think what I'm saying here is that this is paradox. Because if it was okay to worship idols that were subordinate to God, this is, and this was made by idols. But, on the other hand, this man created his own temple.
Hold on one second. Please don't misunderstand me. I did not say it is all right to make idols that are subordinate to God. It obviously is not all right. That's idolatry. What I'm saying is, their intention was to do that. Obviously, it's very simple. It's not correct.
Right, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't say that the right, right way. But the point is that what he did was acceptable in those times as a rebel, as he was a renegade.
Yes.
Period.
He was a renegade.
He was in no way acceptable.
Well, we'll go on with the story. Part of this story is that he did gain a certain amount of notoriety and acceptability, even though his behavior was halakhically, morally, and Jewishly unacceptable.
I thought that's the way you looked at it.
Yeah, he is looked at as a renegade, although, as I say, and as we go through the story, you'll see, it's not clear if he is doing an evil thing or he is doing a stupid thing. I think you do get the view, as we go through the story, that he's just not too bright, that he's innocently trying to do something. After all, his mother, we assume, is benign. His mother says, "Oh, I want to worship God. Take the money and build an idol." It kind of tells you the idea that the paganism of the Canaanite nation did permeate the Jewish people, that they were kind of combining monotheism and paganism and polytheism and all sorts of different things. And Avodah Zarah was not really uprooted from their hearts, even though they combined it with the religion of the Torah. So there's not necessarily an evil here, but there seems to be an ignorance and kind of an obliviousness as to what is going on. But you will see that he does have his followers. You know, it reminds me a little bit of that. Where was that? Was that in Cambodia? It's kind of a crazy thing that's going on. Those twins, those 12-year-old, those little kids are like having in charge of this army of thugs, you know. And they take their orders from these little kids. It seems to be something along that line. Of course, we don't know exactly how old Micha is. He may have been older, but you do get the impression that he's somewhat of a passive character. Because he starts off making himself a Kohen, which is nice, right? You make yourself a Kohen. Well, of course, Kohuna in Judaism is a hereditary status. You cannot declare yourself a Kohen, even if you're very, very righteous. Now then, look at the next thing. Yeah.
What was Shmuel's age at the time when this happened?
Well, Shmuel was not born yet. Shmuel is writing this narrative hundreds of years after it happens.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Shmuel is not alive. He's not alive at this point.
My question is, they are telling us there is no authority.
That's correct.
Where the shoftim or...
Right. So the answer is that in the absence of a melech, a shofet was kind of an ad hoc leader to deal with military issues,
only?
But the Shofet did not preserve the law and order within the communities. In other words, whenever there was a war, they would get a Shofet, but otherwise it was a relatively lawless society.
Actually, it shouldn't be
so
called Shofet, it
would
be called Gibor or something.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
So how come Yoshua didn't leave after being somebody to...
Well, it's true, as we see in the book of Shmuel. Remember, when the Jewish people ask for a king, we do see that Shmuel criticized them, meaning to say, ideally, in an ideal utopian type of world, there shouldn't be a need for that central authority. People on their own, right? Actually, that's what anarchists believe, right? What is anarchy? Anarchy is a social philosophy, actually. You know, there were anarchists. What was it? When the WTO was meeting in Seattle, the group of anarchists wanted to hold a demonstration, but they couldn't get organized. they're having some problem in getting organized because nobody takes leadership. But anyway, anarchy is a social philosophy that basically believes that human beings left on their own will naturally gravitate to goodness, and there is no need for there to be a government. Now, ideally, that would have been the best way for people to be. In other words, Shmuel was hoping that perhaps we could have this environment where we don't need government, we don't need authority. We'll have a shofet in the case of milchama, and then we'll have prophets and saints, tzaddikim, to teach us the Torah, but we don't need this type of authority. What happened was, the period of the shoftim demonstrates that unfortunately, the Yetzer Hara is very, very great, and there is a need for that type of central authority. But it's not ideal, and maybe Yehoshua still envisioned, perhaps, the potential for this ideal to be realized. And that's why he did not leave, you know, any type of malchut. Yeshua himself was not a melech, right? Yeshua himself is somewhat of a shofet, although it's not clear what we call him.
And the Kohanim?
Well, the Kohanim were moral teachers. The Kohanim were not...
Okay, so it won't help.
Well,
moral teacher?
Well, look at society today. I mean, there were moral voices, but apparently without the concept of enforcement, without the concept of authority, moral voices were just not strong enough. Remember that we know that there were large pockets of Canaanites all over the place. We know that there was interaction. We know that there was intermarriage. We know that the Canaanite folk culture did permeate the Jewish practices as well. Why does God always say, you know, get rid of them, don't let them stay? Because God says in the Torah over and over again, you will learn from their ways. And I think what you see is people learn from their ways. But they didn't learn from their ways to become a Canaanite. Rather, it's a much more subtle process. They incorporate various rituals into their Judaism, which is, in a way, more pernicious. It's easier when things are totally separate. So, as I'm saying, that's why I indicated this is at the end of the book of Shoftim, because although it's much earlier, Shmuel the prophet is writing this, wants to show you, and this is why we wind up with a king. Of course, kings didn't help that much either, if you think about it. Some of the kings were corrupt too. But at least this is the hope that with centralized authority, there could be a greater morality and legal observance of the halakha in the population.
The word Baal, about Torah, about Baal HaBayit, right. So much in it's actually a Canaanite god. How come that?
Well, the word Baal in Hebrew means master. Master. So one of the Canaanite deities was called Baal, the master. But Baal itself is more of a common noun, not a proper noun. Meaning Baal means master. It then became a name for the Canaanite idol, my master. But a Baal Korei, a Baal, a husband and a wife, we call Geveret and Baal, right? So it does have meaning.
So did he take it from the Canaanite?
I'm not sure which way it went, but Baal is used to mean master. It's not only used to be an idol.
That
why does it mention he's from Ephraim?
How important
Well, it seems to be that Ephraim was the hilly country, the hilly central country, and it seems to be that there were large pockets of Amorites in the hill country. Part of it was because they had caves and enclaves, which are very difficult to drive them out. So it could very well be there was influence there. It could also be by way of paradox, because Yehoshua himself came from Ephraim. Shaul came from Binyamin. Of course, Binyamin is the villain in the other story. So I think it's trying to say that things were so bad that even within the family that you would expect would be closest to the norms of the Torah, Yehoshua's own tribe, they also, as it were, are disintegrated. Haben Yakir Li Ephraim. Is Ephraim not a precious child to me? Mm-hmm. Now remember, later when the kingdoms got split, the northern kingdom of the ten tribes was ruled by Ephraim. So Ephraim, in that pasuk, is a reference to the lost ten tribes as a whole. In other words, it's called, for example, the southern kingdom is called Malchut Yehuda, and the northern kingdom is called Malchut Ephraim. So Ephraim sometimes means the tribe, and sometimes means the entire northern kingdom. In your pasuk, it means the whole northern kingdom. In this context, it's he is an Ephraimite, a person from Ephraim. Yeah.
Shmuel, having known the judge for you, why does he take a negative action?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Having known all of these stories, he should have endorsed the idea of a melech and not be against it. So many learn the following. Many learn that Shmuel is not against the idea of a melech, and we'll get to this. He is berating the people for having descended to the level where a melech becomes necessary, meaning he's really bemoaning their spiritual degradation. But given the reality of that degradation, a melech would become something that's necessary. We'll look at this in more detail when we get to there, but there's also a connotation that he feels that they are also personally attacking the inadequacies of his leadership. There is a personal element there as well. In fact, Maimonides writes that there was nothing wrong with wanting a king, but the way they asked for it was profoundly disrespectful and improper. Which is another way of looking at it.
Would he like the sentence?
Well, again, though, you know, it's a funny thing. I can't tell you the year when he wrote it. Maybe he wrote this line after he had agreed to the appointment of the king. Right? It may have been after that fact. Now, yeah.
He made a really interesting point, like the fact that the culture permeated.
Yes.
You could even use that as an example for today, that how permeated it is.
Well, very, very much so. You know, not too many of us have idols in our bedrooms or whatever it is. But if the issue is the permeation of culture that is undermining morality, there's no question that this is a great danger all of us face. I mean, you know, I've mentioned a number of times that the big conflict of a Jew in a modern permissive society is what do you let in to your life, to your children's life, to your home? And, you know, there are certainly good things that we let in. Nobody's going to say, you know, don't have a telephone or whatever it is. But what do you keep out? You know, with internet and everything else, and that is a very, very major issue. And although, you know, we're not in favor of ghettos, let's say, you know, we want there to be an open society and have our children see what the world has to offer. But at the same time, you know, there are things that are very poisonous and very, very dangerous. And the person can't really say, "Well, my children are immune to all of these things," because none of us are immune. All of us. You know, it's been well said that once you lose the capacity to blush because one is embarrassed, you never regain it again. And, you know, a person becomes immune to all sorts of things that should normally elicit some outrage or pain, whether it be sexual exploitation, whether it be violence, whatever it might be. So the issue of the environment affecting us is very, very powerful, and you see it over here, that the Jewish people were certainly affected by their exposure to the Canaanite culture. Now, today you might say, well, we don't worship idols, but the Gemara actually tells us that at the beginning of the Second Temple, Ezra prayed that we should no longer have the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. An amazing thing. It was taken away from us. So we don't have it anymore. Now, the Vilna Gaon says, since there always has to be something that tempts you, it was replaced by the desire for money and materialism. So if we want to know what it felt like to want to worship an idol, we have to kind of extrapolate of how much people desire money and things and stuff. So it's interesting. The Gemara tells us that when Ezra was successful in getting rid of the Yetzer Hara for idolatry, he thought, well, let's try another one. Let's try to get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayot, sexual promiscuity. And they were successful. But what happened was people weren't getting married. The chickens weren't cohabitating. So they realized that you can't get rid of certain urges only in bad contexts and not in good contexts. So therefore, we have to get it back. You know, but it's an extraordinary Gemara, because normally the one thing that God does not interfere with is free will. And yet this particular sin, as it were, God interfered with, because it was such a pernicious Yetzer Hara. But of course, Avodah Zarah has many, many meanings. It might very well be, in fact, this might be what the Vilna Gaon means. It may very well be that the Yetzer Hara to worship an idol is largely not within us, although there's still people who do. But Avodah Zarah is, if anything in your life becomes your fetish, your chief priority other than serving God, that becomes your idol. Your idol could be money, could be materialism, could be power. It could be man. Man can make himself an idol. When you put the glorification of your culture as above every other value, one could say that's your idol. Political ideologies can become a person's avodah zarah. A person can worship at the altar of communism, even if that means millions and millions of people, or national socialism, Nazism, even if it means millions and millions of people die because you put your cause, right? So avodah zarah can mean many things, not just, you know, the idol created the world, or whatever.
I know somebody who, his avodah zarah was time. He was so mishug about time, he drove me crazy.
Why? In other words, he had to be exact?
Half an hour before he went to him, yeah. It was avodah zarah.
Well, time is life, you know, time is life. They say the Chafetz Chaim gave his son, he said, "I'm giving you a very precious gift for your bar mitzvah." He gave him a pocket watch. because he said that if you're aware of time, you're aware of
love. Yeah, up to everything in moderation.
Right. You know the story about that time, you know, we have covered Einstein's theory of relativity in terms of time. So, you know, when this came out, you know, it's a very subtle theory, obviously, and when it came out, it somehow, the popular press was very enamored with Einstein, you know, the long hair and not wearing socks, and we just loved Einstein as a pop figure. And they used to say, only five people in the world who understand the theory of relativity and everything else. So they asked Einstein, could he explain relativity of time to a layperson? So he said, yeah, I'll explain and give you a very simple example. He says, if you sit on a hot stove for a minute, it seems like an hour. And then he said, and if you're talking to a pretty woman for a minute, for an hour, it seems like a minute. He says, all time is relative. Okay. Anyway. But going back to the story. All right. So now we have part one. So now look at the next thing. Now the next thing is truly going to shock you, at least at the end of the story. Vayhi nar. Now Micha, he's not even given an age. But now we have a nar. Now nar means a young boy. From Beit Lechem Yehuda, Beit Lechem, of course, in the tribe of Yehuda. Beit Lechem is the famous Beit Lechem, where Rachel is buried, right? Bethlehem. And it's in the tribe of Yehuda. Min mishpachat Yehuda, from the family of Yehuda, v'hu Levi, and he's a Levi. So first of all, what on earth does this mean? We understand how a Levite could be living in Beit Lechem because Leviim didn't have, you know, they had some cities and the cities were all over the place. But how could you describe a person as both belonging to the tribe of Yehuda and the tribe of Levi? So one answer is the following. One answer is, well, his father was a Levi, and his mother was from Yehuda, or vice versa, meaning one parent was from one tribe, one parent was from another tribe. But there's another interpretation, that in fact he was a Levi. In fact, you're going to see, let me just find your verse here. If you look at chapter 18 for a second, because in chapter 18 we are told the name of this person. Look in chapter 18, verse 30. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. The name of this Levi, though this is a name that otherwise doesn't seem to be important, Yonatan, the son of Gershom, the son of Menashe. All right, that's his name. Now again, the Menashe is not the original Menashe. In other words, a person called Menashe. Now, if you look at the word Menashe, if you have an accurate Tanakh, do you notice that the nun is a tiny nun that's raised? And that is taken by the Midrash as an indication that the nun should be deleted. In other words, it's a letter we're putting in, but read it without the nun. If you read it without the nun, whose name does it spell?
Moshe.
And we know that one of Moshe's children was Gershom. And according to rabbinic tradition, Yonatan is none other than the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu. That we will see that the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu was the Levi that we will see eventually became the priest for the idol of Micha. And the reason it says Menashe was, there are two reasons. It was, number one, a bit of a cover-up, but it's a very undisguised cover-up because you put a small letter in. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a cover-up to respect the honor of Moshe. And the other reason is, and again, this goes with, it's an anachronism, it's moving future into the past, and that is one of the evil kings of Yehuda many years later, who was a great idolater, was King Menashe. And therefore, since this Yonatan, who was descended from righteous people, just like Menashe was descended from Chizkiyo, Yonatan follows the path of the evil King Menashe many years later, so he's called a Ben Menashe, meaning a follower of the ways of Menashe. But you understand, it's anachronistic because he couldn't be following Menashe because Menashe is much later. But based on that, the Midrash goes on and says, if you go back into chapter 17, that might be the explanation of why he's called both a Levi and a Yehuda, because Menashe, as all the Davidic kings, is a Yehuda king. So in effect, the same idea, this Levi was also a Yehuda because he followed the practices of some of the Judean kings, namely Menashe. So this is an astounding thing, that Moshe's own grandchild, according to this, joined Micha, and we'll see what he did, in becoming the high priest for this. Now what's even more amazing is, there is a Midrash, which is really very inexplicable, that when Moshe married Zipporah in Midian, right, in last week's Torah reading, and he wanted to go back to Egypt, so he had to convince Yitro to let him go. So there's a Midrash that says Moshe had to swear to him. At that point, Yitro was still a Kohen, a priest for idolatry, that he would let one of his children, or one of his grandchildren, become a Midianite, or become a priest, L'Avodah Zarah. And that was the condition by which Yitro lets Moshe go back. And Moshe made such an oath that one of his children or grandchildren would be a Kohen L'Avodah Zarah in order to get out of there. And the Midrash indicates that God decreed that that would come to pass because of that Shvuah. Now that's really one of the most inexplicable Midrashim. In what sense would Moshe ever make such an oath? I mean, you make an oath that you will allow one of your children to become Avodah Zarah, to worship Avodah Zarah. And there are different metaphorical interpretations. It certainly does not mean that Moshe swore, but rather the concept was that what Chazal are teaching is the dangers of environment, meaning to say, raising your kid in Midian is as bad or as good as if you made an oath you're going to raise him as an idolater, meaning it kind of introduces a recessive gene, which even if it didn't come out in the first generation, comes out much later. In other words, Chazal speak in this metaphorical language. He swore. I mean, he didn't swear, but it's like raising your kid there is as if, you know, you made a commitment to raise him L'Avodah Zarah. Okay, so this is astounding. Now again, if you just read the book of Shoftim without the Midrash, you don't necessarily see this, because his name is not given as Ben Moshe, it's Ben Menashe. Yonatan Ben Gershon Ben Menashe, but Chazal did notice the unusual nun, and the fact that Gershom, happens to be the name of one of Moshe's children. Okay, now there is a tradition though that eventually he did Shuvah, although that's not recorded at all either.
In this book, it says that he was a Levite on his mother's side.
On his mother's side, yeah. According to that, yeah. That's right. But again, according to the tradition that he was Moshe's grandson, mm-hmm. he would be a Levi on his father's side. Now, anyway, so what happened with this? So let's go back to chapter 17. So what happened with him? So he's wandering, and he comes to Har Ephraim, to Beit Micha, and Micha is very hospitable. He says, "Where are you coming from?" And the person says, "Well, I'm a Levi, and I'm wandering around because I can't make a living anywhere." In other words, this is, remember we talked about the fact that even when you had tribal divisions, people would commonly wander from place to place looking for a way to make Parnassah, particularly Leviim that just had different cities. They didn't have whole territories. Vayober Micha. So actually, Micha is very modest here. Micha says to him, this is verse 10, Pasuk Yud, Shava imadi, stay with me. Veheya li liav, and you will be for me a father, Ula Kohen, and a priest. Now this is very interesting. First of all, it may very well be that Micha might even be older. That's why I was thinking of the Cambodian gang than this person. Second of all, the idea of Av is very interesting, because Micha interacts with his mother. You know, where's his father? Maybe like an inner city family, you know, the father is absent, or whatever it is. And Micha now sees this Levi, especially if the Levi has the yichus, the lineage, of being a grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu. And he says, you'll be my father. I mean, imagine the scene, like a 20-year-old taking a 10-year-old and saying, be my father. And he says, and you'll be the Kohen, which means Micha is saying, I'm not a real Kohen, because I'm not from the tribe of Levi. Of course, Yonasan is not a Kohen either, but he's a Levi at least. You're a Levi. You can be the Kohen. You can make us look good. And he says, and I'll give you money. Again, right? For a kid sometimes, you know, I'll offer you money and I'll get you, I'll even pay you 10 pieces of silver per year. You don't know how much that is, though. I don't know, because the idol itself was made out of 200 pieces of silver. So that either tells you how expensive the idol was or how cheap Yonatan's price is, because 10 pieces of silver per year, when the whole idol was 200 pieces of silver, doesn't seem to be very much. And what does the Pasuk say? Pasuk 11, Vayoel HaLevi Loshevet Etoish, and the Levi agreed to dwell with the man. Vayi Hanar Lo Kiachad Mibonav. Look at the mixed metaphor. And this youth became as one of his children. So, fascinating. Micha invites the Na'ar to be his father, but in point of fact, the Na'ar became one of his sons. And Micha supported the Levi, and the Na'ar became the Kohen, and now he's in Beit Micha, and Micha now says, ah, now God will do good for me. Why? Ki haya li ha-Levi le-Kohen, because now I got a real Levi to be a Kohen. I'm doing things right. And if I'm doing things right, God's going to bless me. So at this point, this is a little local temple. Maybe it's not even the only one. Maybe there's a whole bunch of idolatrous temples all over the place. This is a peccadillo of an individual man who managed to snag a very prestigious family into his service. But so far, you know, it's local. It's a very, very local thing. Yeah.
I have a question. In verse 5, it says, "Now the man like that had a house of God. He made a new father to serve him.
Yes.
He had inducted one of his sons."
Yes.
"To be his priest."
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, I misspoke. In other words, Micha did not become the priest himself, but he took one of his sons. There's a switch. In other words, that verse 5 is before he met the Levi. Look at verse 5. You're correct. In other words, what he did was he fired his son.
Okay.
Initially his son, but he's not a Levi. But then when he gets a real flesh and blood Levi, he says, "Oh, now I got the real thing." Okay. So he dumps his son. And in fact, that might be why it says, "And the Levi was like his son," in the sense that just as his son had that priesthood, he now gave it to the Levi. Okay, yeah. Well, it's his temple. It's his temple and it's his idol, right? I mean, he paid for it. That's correct. He stole the money, but his mother gave it back to him. So he can do what he wants, right? So it's an example of he just makes a private temple, a private idol, and he appoints his private priests. And he's very happy. And you'll see, you get the impression that, you know, this is his little shrine, and everything is going well. Now, the next chapter, again, begins, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there was no king, and it discusses something about Shevet Dan. Now, all of you have heard the expression, whenever the land of Israel is described, it says, Midan Yad Be'er Sheva, from Dan until Be'er Sheva. Now, Be'er Sheva, we know, is relatively south because it's in the middle of the Negev, and you know, past that there weren't that many people living there. So Be'er Sheva was the last or the southernmost major city that Jews lived in biblical times. Although there was also Eilat, but actually there's some question, Eilat might not be in the boundaries of Israel. It's interesting, even halakhically, there's some question whether in Eilat one must keep 2 days of Yom Tov or only 1 day. Some say Eilat is actually not Israel. But be it as it may, but the problem is done. Dan is apparently describing the northernmost corner. And yet, if you remember, when we discussed where Shevet Dan was located, they were located somewhere in the middle. So why is Dan the northernmost? So the truth is, the answer to that question is in this chapter. Because Shevet Dan had a population that was too large.
I thought it was from Dan to Beersheba, not Dan.
No, I said Dan. That's what I said. Dan to Beersheba.
Oh, Dan.
Dan, yeah. That's what I said. Yeah, now Shevet Dan's population was too large for its territory. They needed more territory. And apparently, what you get the impression is that although there was a lottery and a division, there were also portions of the land that were not allocated. They were left undivided, so anybody who got them would be able to keep them. And Dan, indeed, conquered a second area all the way north by the Lebanese border. A town that was called Layesh, and that became Dan portion number 2. So when we say Midan, Vyad Be'er Sheva, we are not measuring from Dan in terms of their assigned territory. We are measuring from Dan in terms of their conquered territory, which they conquered the city of Laish, and we're told that Laish was a very isolated enclave of Canaanites that did not have any allies. They were not connected to anybody else. They had a very relaxing life. It says a very low-key, low-pressure life, because they had no natural predators, because they were kind of away from everybody. And Dan came in and took that area over. Right? So that is what is described in the beginning of Perek Yud Chet, is the conquest of the area that is called Laish. Now, what does that have to do with Micha? On the way to their conquest of Laish, let me see, it's on the way there, on the way back, let me just check that. Okay, a few things. First, when they went to conquer Laish, the first thing they did was they sent 5 spies to go up there and check it out. And those 5 spies stopped on the way at Har Ephraim in Micha's house. Micha gave them lodging. And they see this strange thing. They see this temple, and they see this guy that's making believe he's a priest, and they say, what's going on? And the priest answers very honestly. He's a young fellow. He says, well, I've been honored with the great honor of being made a Kohen. And the Danites, who are obviously not great monotheists themselves, say, okay, if you're such a priest, why don't you ask God if we're going to be successful in our military mission? In other words, they want to check him out. And he tells them, yes, you should go, because God shall be with you. And the 5 people go to Laish, they spot it out, and then they return, and they inform the tribe of Dan that we will be able to conquer them, etc. And then what then happens is, Dan sends up an army of 600 soldiers. Again, Laish is a small area, 600 soldiers. And now the 600 soldiers, the 5 people bring the 600 soldiers to this temple of Micha. Says, let's check out this temple. And they come, and what they do is, they simply steal the idol. They say, this is a good idol, let's go and take it. And the Kohen, this...
That shows you how prevalent
yeah.
it was
That's
the
right.
land. I mean,
That's right.
That's
right. That's right. They take the idol. They take that because they want a good luck charm on the way to Laish. And this Kohen, this ineffectual Kohen, is saying, what are you doing? And look at the way they talk. Verse 19. They say, shut up. Put your hand on your mouth and go with us. And we'll make you the father and the Kohen. He says, isn't it better to be a Kohen to a whole tribe than it is just to be a Kohen to one person? And the Kohen liked that proposal. But you see, Kohen, I mean, as if he's a leader. You'll be our leader. Shut up, put your hand on your mouth, don't say anything. And the Kohen goes with them. And of course, what happens here is, Micha is a little upset. And Micha pursues them. And Micha says, what's going on? Why did you do this? And they look at him and say, what's your problem? Malacha, Kinezakta, why are you making so much noise? And these were really a bunch of thugs, essentially. Like, you know, what are you complaining about? And Micha says, the God that I made, you took. And the Kohen that I made, you took. And you're telling me, why am I complaining? And the children of Dan tell him, we don't want to hear your voice anymore, lest there be people who are kind of embittered, meaning we're not responsible for how some people might respond to all the noise that you're making. Uh-huh. In other words, basically, you know, you better watch your mouth or something may happen to you. And we wouldn't, God forbid, we wouldn't want anything to happen to you or your family. So the Bnei Dan continue going. Micha saw that he had to abandon this, and he just went back home. And they took Micha's idols, and they conquered Laish, etc., and the like. And we are told the name of this Levi that they took is the, that's where it says, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menasher ben Moshe. And all of his descendants were the Kohanim for the tribe of Dan. It says, Ad Yom Galot Ha'aretz, until the day of the exile of the land. The exile of the land apparently refers to the exile of the 10 tribes. Again, we have an anachronism, because if Shmuel wrote this, that was well before that. But this is how it's understood. Again, some of these psukim may have been revised in light of history. But apparently we are told that the idol of Micha, although it wasn't Micha's idol then, continued to function as a Danite temple until the exile of the ten tribes, and the priests who officiated in that Danite temple were the descendants of Yonatan ben Gershom ben Moshe. Now, if we understand this, this means to say that even during the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, this was still functioning. Now, in truth, the Midrash reads this in a totally different way. The Midrash says that a Pesel, the tribe of Dan, remember Shimshon also comes from Dan, that the tribe of Dan had strong desires for idolatry, even at the time of Yitziat Mitzrayim. And in fact, there's an amazing Midrash that says the following. This is an amazing thing. That what the Egyptians used to do, they tell you something about Micha, an amazing biographical detail, that the Egyptians used to force the Jews to throw their newborn babies into the mortar of the bricks. And actually, the bodies were actually embedded in the bricks. And the story goes that Moshe once saved a baby from a brick. And that baby was none other than this fellow Micha. Again, it's not clear how old he must have been at this point, because this is many years after the Exodus of Egypt. And the Micha actually had an idol that he had with him during the splitting of the Red Sea. Micha actually had a Pesel even at the time of Kriyat Yam Suf, although it couldn't have been this one because this was made now. And it is said that when the clouds of glory surrounded all the Israelites, it never encompassed the tribe of Dan. Dan was always outside of the Anan because of their propensities towards idolatry. Well, the point of the... Why does it give you that bit of information about Micha? Well, this is what the Midrash says. Whether that means literal or not, you know, we never know. Midrashim are not always meant to be taken absolutely literally. But the suggestion of the Midrash is that within the tribe of Dan, there were strong idolatrous impulses, which came out in this story, but they did exist elsewhere. But again, as I say, what you see in this is the following. What you see in this is, you see compounded offenses. It's not just that Shevet Dan worships an idol, but the way they take it, the way they step. I mean, you could say, well, it's an idol, why shouldn't I take it? But the point is that even if Micha is wrong to worship an idol, that doesn't give Shevet Dan a license to take it, to steal it, to disregard his rights, to talk to him in that way.
It works with him.
Well, that's right. That's Ishkala Yashar B'Einav, meaning you do what is expedient, you do what works for you, you do what gives you advantage. The powerful step on the powerless.
But it also gives them the notion that idols work.
Well, they were successful. In fact, they conquered Laish.
Right.
They took this idol, and they successfully conquered their territory.
You're really giving them the wrong message.
Well, this is Nisayon. If we lived in a world where if you do something bad, you always lose, and you do something good, you always win, there's no free will. Free will means that you don't get that instantaneous feedback.
The temple up in Yisrael, what, he didn't have that Kedusha as the temple in Judah?
Which temple? The temple, Micha's temple?
No.
Oh, Shiloh?
The one is the Assyrian temple.
Which Syrian temple are you talking about?
The Assyrian, there was a temple in Ephraim, up north.
Shiloh, yeah.
Shiloh.
Yes, well, Shiloh was the temporary sanctuary until they built the one in Yerushalayim. Yeah, as long as it functioned, it did have the holiness.
Indeed.
It was like the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the desert. It had that type of holiness. It had an ark, it had all those things.
So why don't we have a Tisha B'Av for that?
Because once it was replaced by the Jerusalem temple, the Jerusalem temple becomes the main one. It superseded, Yerushalayim superseded Shiloh. But until Yerushalayim was conquered by David, there was a Mishkan in Shiloh. Now, we then come to the final, so that's story number one. So chapter 17 and 18 is the story of Pesel Micha. And that shows you really two things. It shows you Avodah Zarah, how prevalent it was. It shows you how amenable the Jews were to environmental influences, and it shows you the lawlessness and lack of respect that people had for each other's property. You just take what you want, and then tell the guy, get out. Now, chapter 19 escalates, ups the ante, and shows things that are much, much worse, culminating in murder, in rape, in violence, in uncontrolled destruction of human life. And this is the infamous story of Pilegesh Begiva. And actually, it also involves a Levi, although this is a different Levi. It says there was a Levi who dwelt in Har Ephraim. So apparently that's a bad combination, right? Levim who gravitate to Mount Ephraim come to bad ends. But there was a Levi who lived in Har Ephraim. He took a Pilegesh. Now the word Pilegesh is a concubine. Mibet Lechem Yehuda, from Beit Lechem. Again, dangerous combination, because if you remember, the Levi also gravitated from Beit Lechem. So here we have the three flashpoints. Ephraim, Levi, Beit Lechem. Let me just say a word about Pilegesh, just to understand this. We, of course, read in Tanakh very often that people had Pilegshim. Now, what is a Pilegesh? So the normal translation is a concubine, which would mean that a Pilegesh is like a mistress who had not been married. In other words, they're not married. Just an extra person. Is a Pilegesh halachically allowed?
Yes.
So the Rambam says no. The Rambam says Pilegesh is not halachically allowed, except for a king, a royal prerogative. A king was allowed to have Pilegshim, a melech, a king could have a Pilegesh, but... Well, a hedyot, a non-melech, is not allowed to have a Pilegesh. And if these people have Pilegshim, it doesn't mean they're doing anything right, they're just doing it. I mean, it doesn't mean...
Not Pilegshim,
but I have a...
Well, it's a good question, but Pilegshim is the word that we use for it. There are other commentaries that do say a Pilegesh is permitted as long as it's an exclusive relationship, meaning to say just prostitution wouldn't be permitted when a woman is with many people, but if she's exclusively with one person, it's kind of a common, you might call it equivalent to a common law marriage type of idea.
So, I have a question.
Well, as you know, I mean, one of these scandals, there are many scandals that the Washington Post, I think, had an article, so it's a few years ago, so it's a public thing, is that there were some people, or there are, because some people who can call themselves religious Jews, who reinstituted the institution of the Pilegesh. Again, this has been really denounced by every reputable person, but they do unearth some isolated opinions that do permit the institution of Pilegesh. But I will tell you a bizarre thing. One of the issues that the Jewish community faces is that of the Aguna. Now, the Aguna is a woman who has been halachically married, but even if there's a civil divorce, she's not permitted to marry until she gets the document called a get. And only the husband can give the get. The court, the Beit Din, cannot just say that you're divorced. And they could try to force the husband, whatever, but if the husband says no, or the husband's not around, she's in very big trouble because she can't marry halachically. And if she tries to marry, any children she would have would be children born from adultery that would be mamzerim, who could not marry others. So the aguna issue, aguna means an anchored or stranded woman, is a very, very serious issue. Some people are dealing with it with prenuptial agreements ahead of time, but even that, prenuptial agreements are not panaceas, because if a person just hides or, you know, is not around, a prenuptial agreement is not going to help you. So one of the bizarre proposals in the 19th century in Morocco was, hey, if there are women who are gunot, because if they're married they can't get a get, let's just abolish marriage. Meaning to say, in order to prevent women from possibly being agunot, let's have relationships that are structurally set up as pilakshim, with agreements, supplementary agreements regarding support, maintenance, and financial responsibilities. You create the financial responsibilities equal to marriage, but you don't make it a marriage. And by not making it a marriage, there'll never be an aguna problem, because a woman that's not married does not need a get.
Now,
oh, okay. Oh, very important, very important. So, no. So the most important thing to know is, a child born out of wedlock is not a mamzer. Only a child born from adultery is a mamzer. If man and woman live out of wedlock, the child has no stigma. So it was thought, again, it's kind of, I don't want to say killing a fly because it's a serious problem, but it's kind of like using an atom bomb to kill a dog, because aguna is a problem. It is a problem. But to say, let's get rid of marriage in order to prevent agunot, seems to be creating an extreme response to a problem that is serious. But, you know, after all, I mean, you know, for every thousand marriages, you may have 10 agunot. So to say, let's not have marriage anymore. But there actually was a proposal. Let's get rid of marriage, create pilagesh, or not create, but institutionalize pilagesh, not as a way of demeaning women, but as a way of protecting women from the specter of being agunot. But again, this was not accepted by, yeah.
Rabbi, explain to me, please, why they said that child born out of wedlock is not considered a mamzer.
That's correct.
But if
he's
relationship
to
the married woman, that's the definition of
yes,
those children would be.
Yes.
Please explain to me the theoretical basis for that.
Well, it is derived from Psukim, and that is to say the following. A mamzer is generated from only two types of relationships. But a mamzer is generated from what is called adultery. That means a man, whether married or single, cohabiting with a married woman. And if the father is the Jew and the mother is the non-Jew, the child is a non-Jew, but there's no mamzer stigma either way. Mamzer is limited to adultery or incest. Now, this, by the way, has created a very important halachic implication, and that is, you know, the biggest problem of mamzer today is not from agunot. There are agunot, but the biggest problem is people who just didn't know they needed a get. In other words, what you have is people were married, and they got divorced civilly, and not thinking about gets, they got married again, in good faith. Everybody's good. I mean, no one's malicious here. They have a child, but in the eyes of Jewish law, they're still married to their first spouse, so the child would be a mom. Now, if, let's say, they are not halachic Jews, so you know, it doesn't bother them, you know, so what? But where you get a problem is, sometimes children of these second marriages have become increasingly observant when they get older, 20, 30, 40. And then they discover that they were born from their mother's second marriage, where she had not gotten a get from the first marriage. And now that they're committed to halakha, they have to discuss the question, are they mamzerim who are not permitted to marry other Jews who are not mamzerim? That's a serious problem. So that's why I would say, to the credits, I do say, to the credits of the many conservative Reform rabbis, they now, although they may not, at least the Reform rabbi does not subscribe to get as a necessity, but they will often counsel their congregants who are going through a marital dissolution that they should obtain a get in order to preserve the options for their children in the future. So that is to their credit, that although they do not subscribe to it as a necessity, they recognize it's needed for options. But what we have in halacha is the following idea. The way these children are sometimes validated is you only need a get to terminate a marriage if the marriage was halachically valid. In other words, if someone was not halachically married, and the issue here becomes that if a halachic marriage requires, let's say, the witnesses be observant and the like, so many of the first marriages may in fact be null and void. And if they're null and void, you don't need a get. Now you then say, oh, but what's that going to do for the children? Nothing. The children are perfectly fine. In fact, I felt very upset once. I once read a letter in the New York Times where a woman was bitterly complaining. She was born from the first marriage, and her sister, her half-sister, was born from the second marriage. And her half-sister became Orthodox and went to Israel, and the Israeli chief rabbinate, in order to avoid a mamzer issue, determined that the first marriage was null and void. So the half-sister would live in the New York Times saying, oh, they make me a mamzer just because they want to protect my sister. The mistake is very obvious. There is no... I mean, I understand emotionally, you know, she doesn't feel so great about making it null and void, but in terms of her status, there's no disability at all on her. The first sister was not stigmatized in any way because of the psak that applied to the second sister. So that letter was, I'm not saying it was deliberate, but that letter was absolutely incorrect in terms of her assertion.
What is the remedy then for somebody who is the child of,
yes,
logically married, becomes a chazer
yeah.
married,
yeah.
Becomes a chazer and did not get it.
They're born from the second marriage?
And
the first marriage, which was halachically valid, they didn't have a get. They're in extreme difficulty, unfortunately. Well, they are a mamzer. Now, a mamzer is not precluded totally. A mamzer could marry a converted Jewess.
And
a mamzer could marry another mamzer. But the problem is, it's going to continue. It's going to continue.
But the problem I have with it is the system is, you know, everything is teaching.
Yeah.
It's so convenient.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's something that doesn't fit about this. That it wasn't an attempt to control people's adult behavior through threatening the sanctity of their children's lives,
well,
rather than putting the control in a way that would affect their
lives.
It's something that doesn't...
Well, listen, it's certainly a very, very hard din to deal with. All I can say is that within halacha, there are many, many mechanisms to avoid this result. For example, at least during a marriage, there's almost 100% presumption. Even if a woman is having affairs, there's a presumption any children she has are from her husband. And in fact, some opinions say that even DNA testing does not shake that presumption. So we really go out of our way. I would also say this. There is a profound lesson in this harshness. And that is, the profound lesson is that what we do does affect our children. I mean, forget about it in this context. In other words, a person can't just say, well, it's my life. I mean, there is a sober lesson here. And that is, well, it's not just our lives. We do things that affect. I mean, I can give you examples from the physical world. You know, there are innocent children that contract AIDS from sometimes behaviors that parents engage in. Now, you could always say, well, why is that fair that an innocent child should suffer? In the moral and spiritual worlds, there are consequences. Now, I know that we bend over backwards to look for ways out. Occasionally there are no ways out. Very often there are. Sometimes there are not. I can't explain everything other than to say I think it's the nature of this universe that actions have consequences, and the consequences can sometimes be very, very, very tragic. But nevertheless, in terms of being a Jew, the Gemara says a beautiful phrase. It says, a mamzer who's a Talmid Chacham, if he learns the Torah, is greater than a Kohen Gadol, who's an ignoramus. Meaning, ultimately, there are disabilities here, but in the ultimate spiritual hierarchy, what you achieve is higher than where you came from.
How could he learn Torah if he can't come into Kahal Yisrael?
Well, can't come in means he can't marry certain people. It doesn't mean he's
not...
But
I mean, he can go to Jewel?
Oh, of course, absolutely. We give him an aliyah. I mean, you know, or we would... mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, sure. I mean, he could become a rabbi. I mean, he's not deprived of anything. Well, he's deprived of choice of marriage partners, which is obviously very, very big.
So the Kahal Yisrael,
he does have full membership in the Jewish community.
Who is saying Kahal Yisrael?
Well,
saying
Kahal Hashem refers to marriage. Marriage. Lo Yavo is he cannot enter the community in terms of marriage.
In the eyes of the rabbinah, a married man which has a legate, is adultery?
It is not adultery.
Not?
It is not adultery.
Is this it?
Pilegesh, the concubine, Pilegesh. Well, this is the old, you know, this is the old double standard. I mean, again, let's go back. I mean, let's go back to the basic biblical rule. The basic biblical rule is that if a married woman cohabits with another man, he and she are guilty of adultery. Right? That's the basic rule. On the other hand, if a man cohabits with a married man cohabits with another woman, he can even have two wives. Polygamy is permitted on the part of the male, although polyandry is prohibited on the part of the female. I mean, that is the basic structure. The only reason we don't, you know, men don't take multiple wives, well, it's against the law, but the only reason halakhically that men don't take multiple wives today is because of a ban that only goes back to the 11th century of Rabbeinu Gershom that prohibited polygamy for Ashkenazic Jews, and Ashkenazic Jews from Germany, Poland, and Russia, and Sephardic Jews from Morocco and Tunisia and Egypt are halakhically permitted to have more than one wife. Of course, in the state of Israel, they passed the law that it was usur, but they allowed, they had a grandfather clause in, meaning to say that any immigrant from an Arab country that had more than one wife was allowed to bring them over. I think there might be a few pockets. I mean, obviously, people are yeah.
What happens if a mom
doesn't
take the
okay.
Oh,
well, that's good, but a mamzer is not allowed. Yeah, the iser is not just marriage. The iser is sexual relations with another Jew. So that would still be a prohibited, not a union, but a prohibited relationship. Now, I will say one thing. There is one cure. How do you prevent mamzerut from going to the next generation? Once you have a mamzer, you can't get rid of it. Because if you marry another mamzer, the child is a mamzer. And if you marry a convert, which is permitted, the child is a mamzer. How do you get rid of it? So the Talmud says there is one way you could get rid of it, but you're not allowed to do that. And that is, if a male mamzer were to marry a non-Jewish woman, which he cannot, the child would be a goy, a non-Jew. If the non-Jew then converts, that erases all the past. That is a way, but it's not a permissible way. Because a mamzer cannot marry a non-Jew. There is a permissible way at a time when there was slavery, which doesn't apply today, and that is, a mamzer is permitted to marry a non-Jewish slave, a shifcha kenanit, and in such a case, the child would have the din of an eved kenani, and when you free an eved kenani, that also erases the status. So there are, you know, there are different ways, but that doesn't apply to it.
What is the same with the child of the concubine
who is
Jewish?
That child would be a mamzer, of course. No, I'm sorry.
No.
If the man is married, and has a child from the concubine, the child is fine.
Okay.
No problem. Unless the woman is married, there is no mamzer that is connected. Yeah.
Rabbi, what was going on in the time of Rabbi Gershon in the Ashkenazi world that led to his making?
Yeah, there are a few things.
Yeah,
there are a few things. First of all, the issue was that you'll notice that Sephardim lived in Islamic countries where polygamy was a common practice. Ashkenazim lived in Christian countries where polygamy was a prohibited practice. Rabbeinu Gershom number one felt it was a chilul Hashem, it was a desecration of God's Torah, that the Jews should be more permissive in this type of practice than were the non-Jewish cultures. And therefore he felt that we should not do the practice. Also, economics were very, very severe. The Jewish people were extremely impoverished, and basically people were not able to take care of their families, and it was considered to be destructive to the social welfare system. At the same time, in Rabbeinu Gershom's time, very early marriage was extremely common. Girls were commonly married at the ages of 10 or 11. because it was a way of providing some economic security for children. So he abolished polygamy, but he encouraged child marriages. Rabbeinu Gershom made it two other enactments which are very important. One other enactment is a woman cannot be divorced against her will, which is actually very important. Under biblical law, a woman could be divorced whether she liked it or not. He enacted that the woman must consent to the get. And the third thing he enacted was a prohibition against opening people's mail, a right to privacy. So these are all called the cherem, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Just to give you a sense, Rabbeinu Gershom was the teacher of Rashi's teacher. So Rashi is three generations from Rabbeinu Gershom. And he's called by the appellation Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola, the light of the exile. That is the honorific title that he's given.
And a woman can't get a divorce without her will.
No, she cannot.
Also not.
No, but
it's the same.
So essentially you need mutual consent.
Yes.
You need mutual consent. Uh-huh. That's correct, yeah.
Why was his bans like followed? Why can't you make a ban about Aguna now?
Right. Well, the answer is because Rabbeinu Gershom was not just, you know, the rabbi of the city. Rabbeinu Gershom was an authority that was universally accepted by the Ashkenazic communities. So he was like the I don't want to say the Pope, but he was the central authority. We don't have really that type of centralized authority today. You know, you have Hasidim, Misnagdim. There is no group that has this authority to promulgate gezeirot for all of the Jewish people. All right, so here's the story. The original cherem, cherem means an excommunication. So if you violate it, you can be excommunicated. Had an expiration date, the beginning of the sixth millennium. Now, we're now in the seventh. I'm sorry. The beginning of the sixth millennium. We're now 5,761 years. So the expiration date was originally over 700 years ago. That would have taken you to the 1300s. However, it is said in the books of Halakha that it was renewed before its expiration. So it's originally, it did have an expiration date, but they extended it. So that's the idea of the Mamzer. And again, it certainly is a difficult set of Halakhot. But be it as it may, the story, and what time do you have? Okay. I just want to tell the story briefly, and then we'll flesh out the details. The story basically is, and it's very reminiscent, it's an amazing parallel. If you remember the story of Lot and Sodom, Lot sees the angels, and Lot doesn't know that they're angels. He invites them into his house. And of course, in Sodom, there's a strict anti-hospitality policy. So the Sodomites, by the way, why was that? The Medrash said an interesting thing. It wasn't just that they were evil. But Sodom was a very prosperous society. I mean, think about the parallel today. Very prosperous society, and they were afraid of poor people immigrating into their society to take advantage of the welfare resources. So they were so, as it were, particular that outsiders shouldn't take advantage of their wealth, that if you even gave somebody hospitality, they would demand that that person be delivered. And they surround Lot's house, and they say, "Bring out these men that are with you, so that we may know them." And of course, that's always understood as we can have homosexual frolicking with them. V'neida'a otam. And then Lot makes this very, very strange thing. He says, "Oh no, I do not mishandle, I do not mistreat my guests. Here are my two virgin daughters. I'll give you them, and you can have them." Big tzaddik, right? And of course, what happened was that they did not go out. The angels took over and smote the Sodomites with blindness, etc. And then they took Lot out, and the city of Sodom was destroyed. Well, you have a very, very similar story. I mean, this is parallel. That this man is wandering around, and he seeks hospitality in the home of a Binyaminite in the city of Geba. And for some reason, the Binyaminites surround the house. And they say, "Deliver this man so we may know him." But here, the Levi says, "Don't bother me, I'll give you my pilegesh, take my concubine." Again, you see how it's compounded and compounded. Look at what the Binyaminites are doing, and look how the person responds. How does he treat, you know? All right, she's not a wife, but I mean, this is someone he has a connection to. And he says, "Take her!" You know? And they rape her all night. And in the morning, she's found dead. We don't know if they killed her, or the repeated abuse killed her, or exposure. We're not really told. But in the morning, she's lying on the porch, dead. He opens the door. Even if he finds her lying, and he says, "Wake up, get up." I mean, even that, the way he says, "Wake up," and he sees that she's dead. He takes no responsibility for this. He's outraged at what they did, even though he was the one that sent her out. And he cuts up her body into 12 pieces, and he sends a piece to every tribe, saying, "See what the Binyaminites did." I mean, they didn't. In other words, they murdered her. So, you know, he's hardly in a position to be such a great tzaddik. He delivered her, and of course, one could ask the question: 12 pieces? I mean, the event happened in Binyaminites. So, who are the 12? You think it's only 11? Either he counts Levi as a tribe, Ephraim, Menashe, Levi, or else maybe the Binyaminite leadership needed to become aware of what went on here. And what happened was that a massive army of the other tribes went to Binyaminite, and they demanded that they deliver the perpetrators to justice, extradition. And the Binyaminites refused. And I think I had mentioned last week that the issue of this story was actually one of tribal prerogatives. That the tribe of Binyamin took the position that we are a separate country. Every tribe is a separate nation. And if somebody committed a crime in our territory, you don't have international tribunals. In other words, they regarded, you know, the Jewish court as being an international tribunal. And their argument is, this was a local crime, and we will take care of it. That's how Nachmanides understands the story. On the other hand, they said it's a local tribe, we'll take care of it, but they didn't take care of it either. They say, you know, boys, let boys be boys, or whatever it is. And the narrative goes on, we'll go over this in some more detail, the narrative goes on that there was a massive civil war. Now, the numbers are totally disproportionate. There were an army of 400,000 Jewish soldiers, in other words, the rest of the Jewish soldiers, against only less than 30,000 Binyaminite soldiers. The Binyaminites are outnumbered more than 10 to 1. And yet, in 2 days of struggles, the Binyaminites inflicted tremendous casualties on the Jewish people. An amazing thing. This little band, 10 to 1, or one out of 10, was able to defeat. The third day, the Jewish people were victorious, and they crushed the Binyaminites. And the story goes that the tribe of Binyamin was almost totally decimated. There were only a few hundred men left, and no women. And the story goes, each man had taken an oath that they would never allow their daughter to marry a Binyaminite. So if you combine that oath with the destruction of the women and the very few men that are left, that would mean that the tribe of Binyamin would have been totally destroyed. And this is a dilemma. They made an oath, but they didn't want to have a tribe destroyed. So look what they did. They think of, I mean, this is just one thing after another thing. So they think, well, gee, when we got together to take this oath and wage war against Binyaminite, was there any town that did not participate? And there was one town that didn't participate. And of course, that town has to die because they didn't participate in the military effort. So the men of that town get massacred, and 400 women are taken who are then made available. I mean, look at the logic here. Meaning, if the town would have participated, the women wouldn't have been available because they would have taken the oath. So they say, oh, the good news is, since you didn't take the oath, your women are available for the Binyaminites. The bad news is, since you didn't take the oath, we're going to kill you. So they wipe out the city of Yavesh Gilad, which is on the east bank of the Yarden. They take 400 women and they make them available because, well, you didn't make an oath, so therefore you're allowed to marry the Binyaminites. And that takes care of 400 people. And then there's still a few hundred left. There are only around 600. There are less than 1,000 men left. And then there's another thing that say, well, when the women dance around during the grape harvest, they tell the Binyaminites, why don't you just kidnap them? Because that's not a violation of the oath. Because the oath was only that a parent will not give his daughter to a Binyaminite. But if you take them while they're dancing, that's going to be permitted. And they take them. And this is supposed to be a reconciliation and a simcha that the tribe of Binyamin is able to be reestablished. And as a result, the book ends once again with this note, Yamim Haheim Ein Melech Yisrael. This is what happens when there's no king. Ish Hayashar Bi'Eina Yaseh.
Thank you.
People,
enjoy.
Yeah, thank you. People do what they want. In other words, even when they try to accomplish something that they think is good, I mean, you see what it involves. I mean, they wipe out a city because the city didn't participate in the oath, and then they take the women and make them available because the city didn't make the oath, and then they advise Binyaminite, well, we can't give you our daughters, but you can kidnap them because we're not giving them to you, and we're telling you they will be available at such and such a time and such a place. You can go ahead and take them. And this is what goes on. So you see already how degenerate. Now again, this doesn't mean everybody, although I mean, this is really all of the people involved in this particular incident. But you see the consequences of Ish Kol HaYashar HaYashar Bi'Eino. So the story of Pesel Micha and the story of Pilegesh B'Givah are really one of the saddest episodes in the pre-monarchy stage. Yes. The reason we know this is number one, reference to it says Pesel Micha was worshipped all the years of the Mishkan in Shiloh until the exile. Now, if it's at the end of the Judges, Shiloh had been around for a few hundred years. So this indicates that it goes all the way back to Mishkan Shiloh, which is in the days of Otniel, and also the conquest of Dan. We know that from Yoshua, that the conquest of the extra territory of Dan was very early in the period of the Judges. It was not later. Okay, maybe we'll stop. And again, next week we'll just have one more session on the book of Shoftim. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want.